This week. We flicked the switch on a strange musical invention that emerged in the early 20th century from the unlikeliest of places. The power socket in your home.
If you put an electric motor in the wall, the power went up, the motor would run fast. Or if the power came down, the motor would run slow.
When first unveiled, this strange new instrument spooked audiences.
There was a sense that this was a weird sound. It didn't sound quite right. There were some who felt this was the devil's instrument.
Cased in an oversized brown box that looked a bit like a coffin, only the brave would prize the back of it.
You open the back, and it's just the guts. You look at the guts, that thing is, it's intriguing. All that stuff is in there.
The story goes that some who played it were driven mad by its unearthly noise.
He used to plunge knives into the gaps between the keys at certain dramatic moments in solo.
Yet for several decades, it's been beloved by the most influential and celebrated musicians to walk this planet.
Words of James Brown, give me smoggin. You know, everybody understood what he meant, but he said, let me hear some organ.
And underscored some of the biggest hit singles of all time. I'm Nick Mason. I play the drums in Pink Floyd. You're listening to a history of music and technology on the BBC World Service. For the next hour, we'll be spinning tone wheels, pulling out drawbars, and turning up the volume on what is recognised as the world's most famous electric organ, the Hammond. It's an instrument I know well because my bandmate, Richard Wright, used a Hammond on a number of our albums. From A Saucer Full of Secrets to Dark Side of the Moon. But the story of this instrument stretches much further back than that of Pink Floyd.
I have people ask me all the time when they ask me what I do for a living, and I try to explain it. If you ever see anybody playing on stage and it's this wooden box with four legs and there's two keyboards, and the funny thing is almost everyone in the world's heard one multiple times in their lives and people don't realize what it is.
This is Paul Chalk, the owner of the Chicago Organ Company, located in the northwest of the city. Today, Paul's business restores and sells vintage Hammonds, but for almost 50 years it was in this very building where almost 2 million Hammonds were built and manufactured.
The first instrument you see when you walk in is a vintage Hammond Novachord. The one that's here is actually out of the CBS Studios of New York. It's been passed down from generation to generation. It weighs about 600 pounds conservatively. We broke one of my dollies getting it in here because it's so heavy. There was just around 1,000 made. I don't know how many are still known in existence. If you bought it now, then it would have cost about $500,000 if my numbers were right. This was used for all the early sci-fi movies and special effects.
But who exactly created this intriguing machine? His name was Lawrence Hammond, and by all accounts, he was a shy, retiring man who didn't even know how to play a musical instrument. Some even claim he was tone deaf. Hammond was instead an avid inventor and liked nothing better than to spend long hours tinkering with machinery in his factory.
He had other things that he made, like a bridge table. This is crazy if you've ever seen one of these work. It's a table, people play the card game bridge, and you put a couple decks of cards in the thing and press a button and it would deal the bridge hand out to four people sitting there. Have you ever seen one work? It's crazy.
Scott May is Artist Relations Manager for Hammond USA and organist with the band Ides of March.
In the beginning of the 20th century, when electricity came into homes, the power that came into the homes wasn't always the same. If you put an electric motor in the wall, the power went up, the motor would run fast. Or if the power came down, the motor would run slow. So Lawrence Hammond invented what's called a synchronous motor, that no matter what the power that came in and out, that motor went at the same RPM. Now, he said, okay, so I got this motor. What am I going to do with it? Well, his first inclination was to invent an electric clock because it's going to run at the same speed. And it was an immediate hit. And he sold a lot of them. They had great business. And then, boom, the stock market crash and the Great Depression hit. and all of a sudden nobody's got any money for a Hammond clock, and his business went. At the same time, I have to mention a thing called the teleharmonium, which was an invention by a chap named Thaddeus Cahill. Now, dig this. This was in a huge building, and he had these huge wheels that had grooves on them and a steam engine in the basement. And the steam engine would drive pulleys and would spin the wheels, and there were electric pickups in front of these huge wheels, tall as a man. And there was an organ-type console in the basement, and a fellow played, and these things made sound. And the idea was is that they would take that music, pipe it out over the telephone wires, and into people's houses. Lawrence Hammond looked at that and said, why do those wheels have to be so big? So he shrunk the wheels down to about the size of a quarter. These wheels look like gears, and the one that's A440's got 440 grooves on it. He worked out the harmonic series. And he, you know, took an old piano keyboard and he put his motor on there and put the wheels in the motor and started playing it and do-do-do-do-do, hit an octave. And he says, wow, I've made an electronic flute. And they thought, wait a minute, what's a pipe organ? A pipe organ is nothing but a big box of flutes.
But before manufacturing even started, Hammond faced opposition right from the off.
The musicians' union tried to say it's not a real organ. It's not an organ. An organ's got to have pipes. And I think the pipe organ manufacturers, too, back in the early 30s, they were like, well, what are we going to do? A Hammond organ was a lot less expensive than a pipe organ. And so what they did is they set up a Hammond organ in the Rockefeller Chapel in Chicago, Illinois. And they have a huge Aylin Skinner, which Aylin Skinner is like the Rolls Royce of classical organs, pipe organ. And they had a panel of music scholars. They blindfold them. And they set up the Hammond organ with big speakers. And they couldn't tell the difference. Eventually, Hammond Organ 1 said that they can call their instrument an organ and not an electronic keyboard. The splash was immediate. There's an old wives' tale that Henry Ford got the first organ, the first couple of organs. He didn't. There was a widespread rumor that George Gershwin got one of the first organs. He didn't. The first organ went to a dealer, I want to say in Omaha, somewhere in the middle of the country, and say Mr. Hammond did not want his instrument to play popular music. He wanted it to play church music, classical music, and the popular tunes of the day.
It's amazing. Such wonderful tones, and so many.
You know, I played a Hammond in our small church before this one was built.
I'm convinced that I found an organ that will meet all my wishes.
The first Hammonds rolled off the production line in 1935. And as Lawrence Hammond wanted his electric organ to be adopted by churches, he'd certainly found himself in the right place at the right time. From the late 19th century, America witnessed the mass migration of black people moving from the South to the North, looking for job opportunities and to escape the racist Jim Crow laws. Thanks to this influx, a new sound emerged from the churches of 1930s Chicago, a sound which mixed spiritual singing with early blues and jazz. Bob Maravich is the founder of the Journal of Gospel Music.
The Hammond organ suits gospel music because it plays into this idea of the call and response. Call and response or antiphonal singing is very important in gospel music, where there's a lead singer who sings a line and then the choir responds or the congregation responds. And the organ was a response mechanism. Also, it sounded like the human voice. It sounded like a human voice in the throes of spiritual ecstasy. And it would help to bring the entire experience to a high pitch, where then, once the release happened, it was a Holy Ghost party.
One of the first church leaders to spot the potential of the Hammond organ was a Reverend Clarence Cobbs, who in 1939 founded the First Church of Deliverance in the south side of Chicago, a church still going strong today.
My name is Pastor James R. Bryson, Jr., and I am the pastor of First Church of Deliverance, and we're about to enter into the sanctuary to look at four generations of Hammond organs that we have utilized down through our almost 90 years history.
Coming to you directly from the main sanctuary of the First Church of Deliverance, the spiritual church of love and faith. We are located at 4315 South of Wabash Avenue in Chicago, Illinois.
So this is the sanctuary, the magnificent sanctuary of the First Church of Deliverance. Some, as a friend of ours would have called it, is the Opera House. Who is that? Nash. Brother Nash. Here the organ is king. And so this is the latest one that we just got last year. It's one of the first things I did when I became the pastor. I always loved the Hammond organ, and even the new ones, right? They don't have the cranking sound. You know, I used to say you got to warm her up. But they thought so much of that tradition that they still put the lever here, but it does nothing. For this one, all you got to do is turn it on. Instrument could captivate this kind of space.
Reverend Clarence Cobbs, who founded the church, was always looking for something that would make his church stand out, whether it was the architecture or the gospel singing or just the flamboyance of the church. He was one of the first to have a radio broadcast. The wattage of the radio station could be heard in several states in Canada. Kenneth Morris was a jazz musician by trade. He was hired as the music director at First Church of Deliverance. Kenneth Morris had heard about the Hammond organ and persuaded Cobbs to buy it for the church.
Give me a reassurance that the Lord is on my side.
Stanley Davis is a local historian and has been a member of the Church of First Deliverance since 1968.
Mr. Morris discovered this Hammond organ, and I had a long talk with him about that because I was just fascinated. I said, well, how did you stumble? And he said, the difference with the Hammond organ and the pipe organ was that it had an immediate, instant response. When you depress the key, bam, you got a sound.
In the days where we didn't have drums, we had to keep the beat on the organ, right? And so Stanley's asking me to play something, and you'll see.
The reaction of the public to the Hammond organ in church was mixed. There were some who felt this was the devil's instrument. You know, this was jazz music, this didn't belong in the church. There was a reporter in Chicago by the name of Nyota Dyett, and she reported in 1935. It was a wonderful instrument, but she never thought it would quite catch on in churches because of its eerie tone. But that's exactly why Cobbs wanted it and Morris wanted it.
You can feel the pulse of the music like that, right? And you can't do that on a pipe organ. I've tried, right? I've tried. Because when you hit this, you're getting what you hit.
Soon, the Hammond organ would find itself in places of worship across America, creating the perfect training ground for aspiring organists. One of those who cut his teeth in church in Los Angeles in the early 50s was Clarence McDonald.
Now, the one thing about being in church is you got a $1 million education that you didn't even know you were getting.
In a career spanning 7 decades, Clarence has played with everyone, from Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin to James Taylor and Justin Timberlake.
First of all, you got ear training, because when Sister Johnson got up to sing, she'd say, and by the time she got the Amazing Grace, you better have found the tonic and been playing with it. Don't realize this was the original synthesizer. You start to play, you pull out draw bars. Ooh, I like that. And the other thing was the fun of playing the foot pedals, because that was the instrument where you had to be dexterous. You had to use both hands and your feet. if you wanted to keep up with the big boys.
By the mid-1950s, the Hammond organ had burst out of churches and into nightclubs and recording studios.
Jimmy Smith, you're going to hear about him.
And it was down to this man, Jimmy Smith, who, thanks to his show-stopping style, helped popularize the Hammond in the world of jazz. Eventually, he would be dubbed the King of the Hammond Organ. But he first came across the instrument while playing with big bands in the Philadelphia area. Here's Jimmy talking to the BBC in December of 2000 about an early encounter with organist Wild Bill Davis.
I asked him, how long would it take me to learn how to play the organ? He said, it would take you 15 years alone to play the pedals. I said, wait a minute, whoa, 15 years? So what I did, when I first got my organ, I put a chart up on the wall of 3 feet by 3 feet. And I had an artist friend of mine. He did the pedals for me in black and white. So I wanted to look down to where I was sitting. I was playing 3 months. So I was playing opposite him around the corner from Atlantic City, and I killed him.
I kept watching to find out where he kept his extra 2 hands. Because how can you play all of this with just 2 hands and 2 feet, and one of them's on the volume pedal? He could be playing something rock solid bass and comping with his left hand and playing a solo that you could only dream about with his right hand. The organ was born to him. Jimmy had a club, a nightclub in L.A. You go to a nightclub and you're young and you're trying to play. The guys were nice enough to beat you up in a nice way. Richard Groove Holmes had a hearse. That's what he carried his organ in. Jimmy would play you under the table. Richard Groove Holmes would do exactly what his name said. He would groove you into bad health. Try carrying a Hammond up to the second floor of a nightclub. Put it on your back, get the hump, and start walking up the stairs. You know, as you get older, guys take pity on you, and then you start to make enough money to where you had roadies who would do that. But yeah, the idea of carrying an organ around, that was the only thing about the Hammond I didn't like, okay?
Weighing nearly 450 pounds, the Hammond organ was far from portable. But then it had been designed to sit in churches and homes, not survive a 20-city tour across the US. This is Hammond technician of over 40 years, Ray Gerlich.
Hammond was in the business to manufacture a product that they could sell to the greater masses. There was not really a lot of thought about building a jazz organ. That kind of evolved from what they were doing.
Since 1935, the company has released over 100 different models, catering for a wide variety of uses, from cheap entry-level organs for the home to deluxe models with a sound big enough to fill a concert hall.
Sometimes it seems like we live in a dull, gray world. Well, I've found a way to change it.
Wonderful things happen with the sounds of a Hammond organ. Only Hammond has features like notochord. Keys stay down after you play each chord, so learning is easy and fun. Make your musical dreams come true with a Hammond organ.
Some of the home organs were called the Dolphin series. There was a Aurora series. There was a Colonnade, the Concorde, the Monarch.
While some organs were assigned memorable monikers, most were named after the letters in the alphabet. And although the organs in each series would be fitted with the latest technology, every Hammond was built around several key features. 2 keyboards, an upper solo manual keyboard, a lower keyboard for accompaniment, and the pedals which allow the organist to provide the bass sounds. But perhaps the most distinctive physical feature of the Hammond are the little metal sliders located just above the keyboard that look like faders on a mixing desk. What do they do? They manipulate the volume, which creates different sounds, or voices, as musicians like to call them. And to an organist, these are called the drawbars.
You could vary the volume of a particular frequency, what you would have called a rank of pipes, and you could mix them with all the other voices and create a pseudo reed voice or a string voice, any of those sounds that you wanted. There was a claim to being somewhere in the 256 million voices. You know, you'd have to spend a lot of time moving the drawbars to get all those different sounds, but it was mathematically possible.
For musicians like Jimmy Smith, the drawbar settings were part of their distinctive sound, and so often a closely guarded secret. But more importantly, there was one model of Hammond, adored by Jimmy, and many more to follow in his footsteps. Manufactured between 1955 and 75, the B3 was Jimmy's organ of choice. But what was it exactly about the B3? Ray Gerlich again.
The jazz musician likes the feel of the key. Fire is very fast, what we call key travel. You can hear as I play the key slowly, all the different tones coming in. And musicians love that, because when they play, they end up hearing the key contacts coming in, the tones coming in as they play, and as they slap the keyboard and that, they get partial tones of the organ, and that's what they really like to hear. Let's see if I can actually do anything that'll sound right. The other thing is on here, we do have percussion. Let's see if I can get it to work for me. Turn off all the drawbars so you can hear it. But percussion was one of the last features added to the B3, and that's so that they can take a couple of the frequencies and they make them sound like a piano. There's a fast attack and then a fast decay, and they used to use that as an accent to the sound. So the musician could now emphasize his playing depending on how he did things.
Coming up after the break, the story of the man who helped the organ make its mark on musical history, despite being blackballed by Lawrence Hammond himself.
Somehow, Lawrence Hammond felt that organ was his, and he said he didn't want anything like that put on his organ.
Plus, we'll hear from the organists who harnessed the power of the Hammond to help create some of the most memorable songs of all time.
As I'm standing in line with the old age pensioners, and I tapped the woman in front of me with her two walking sticks, I said, "Oh, that was me, mate." No, don't do that. It brings a smile to everybody's face, what can I say, every time you hear it.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. Welcome back to A History of Music and Technology. I'm Nick Mason from Pink Floyd, and as we heard in the first half, this week we've plugged in a Hammond to find out why it became the most successful electric organ of the 20th century. It was born in Chicago in the 30s, quickly adopted by gospel churches, and then in the 50s it set jazz on fire. Coming up, as popular music took hold, we'll hear how organists captivated concert goers.
I tipped it on its side. So I climbed on the top of the side and started playing it that way around. But then they took notice.
But first, we've come this far without mentioning one of the Hammond's most vital organs, the Leslie Speaker.
You can give your home organ music concert hall richness and realism by placing an external Leslie Speaker cabinet at some distance away from the organ. No doubt you've already heard the name Leslie Speakers, but you may not yet be aware of the many acoustical benefits possible with a separate Leslie Speaker cabinet placed away from your organ.
It would be easy to mistake this rectangular wooden box, which stands about a meter high, for a drinks cabinet or a large pedestal. But the Leslie Speaker was more than just a piece of furniture. In fact, it was more than just an amplifier and a loudspeaker. And it was invented by a man who had nothing to do with the Hammond Organ Company. Here's Scott May, again from Hammond, USA.
There was a fellow, his name was Donald J. Leslie. And Don loved the Hammond organ, but he thought it sounded a little square. And again, remember that Mr. Hammond did not want his instrument to play popular music. Don was a fan of the theater pipe organ, Mighty Wurlitzer. Those are the organs that were invented to accompany silent movies. And the big thing between a classical organ and a theater organ is what's called a tremulant. A tremolo is like a ha, 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 ha. It's like a vibrato and a cyclical change in the volume. And it's very distinctive. He hit on the idea of using a thing called the Doppler effect. When you see a train go past you, the train goes... Now, really, that train is making the same noise. But the Doppler effect is a principle of physics. When it's right by you, you get the real pitch, and as it goes away, the pitch goes down. So Don thought about taking a speaker and rotating it so that the sound would, when it was facing you, to be one pitch, and as it turned away, it'd be another pitch, and the volume would be different, and the pitch would be different.
Excited by his new invention, Donald Leslie's first port of call was, of course, the Hammond Organ Company in Chicago. Here, in an interview with the BBC in 1989, Donald reveals what happened next.
They called in many organists and other people, demonstrated the speaker. Everyone thought it was just terrific. At the end of the session, I took the speaker out and said, if I don't hear from you within 30 days, I'm going to start making them and selling them. Somehow, Lorenz Hammond felt that organ was his, and he said he didn't want anything like that put on his organ. Every Hammond dealer that handled this was at odds with Hammond. Dealers would call me and want to get in on this. And this was the best sales tool that I had, because after they sold an organ, they would whisper to the customer, now, I want to show you something down my basement. And so down they went, and of course, they always went out with the Leslie speaker.
But a stubborn Lorenz Hammond held out till the end. It wasn't until after his death in 1973 that his company eventually started selling Leslie speakers. But back in the 60s, the potential for both to help take popular music in a new experimental direction had been spotted early on by some of the biggest and brightest musicians of the day. From the Beatles... I love the colorful clothes you wear. To the Beach Boys. And the way the sunlight plays upon her head. And of course, let's not forget my band, Pink Floyd. I remember recording the track Echoes, which featured on our sixth album, Metal. We connected a grand piano up to a Leslie with a microphone on both sides of the cabinet. You've got to remember, in those days, there were no effects units or computers to call upon. The Doppler effect created by the speaker gave us this extraordinary pinging sound, just like the noise of a submarine hunter. But Hammonds and Leslies weren't just deployed for experimental studio work. By the early 60s, the instrument was finding itself front and centre of some of the biggest hits of the day. David Hepworth has been writing about music for five decades.
I think one of the pivotal records is Give Me Some Lovin' by the Spencer Davis Group. That long drum and bass intro, and then when's it going to come? When's the dam going to burst? The key hook of Give Me Some Lovin' is the organ. The wonderful record then, and it's still a wonderful record now. Where it starts to change is with the dawning of prog. You started to get occasions where the kind of keyboard player was sort of the lead instrument. And I suppose the trailblazers in this regard were the Nice. Very difficult to glamorize that instrument. And so Keith Emerson used to go to extraordinary lengths. He would go round the wrong side of his Hammond organ and then play it from the other side, as if this was some extraordinary act of skill. And later on, he used to plunge knives into the gaps between the keys at certain dramatic moments in solos. We would all sit there and go, wow, that's amazing. We didn't think, what an idiot.
That was very Keith. It was very unique, and he did it right to the end, bless him.
This is Rick Wakeman, another prog-rocking organist, who with his bands Straubs and Yes helped put the Hammond centre stage during the 1970s.
I was with Straubs, who were in essence at the time a folk band, and we did a piece called Where Is This Dream of My Youth?
Where is this dream of your youth?
Which had quite a long organ solo. And let's put it this way, the folkies weren't getting it at all. So I gave the organ a little rattle and there's a couple of explosions, which woke them up. And then I tipped it on its side. So it's now making huge explosive noises. So I climbed on the top of the side, if that sort of makes sense, and started playing it that way around. Then they took notice. It started to get even sillier. I used to push it, so it would go rolling across the state, and then I'd run after it and chase it. This was a Boston Glidodrome, and I pushed it and tripped over the wires and watched the Hammond go off the edge of the stage. I tried to catch it and went over with it. I'm sort of cut and bruised and a bit of blood everywhere, and the organ was a bit smelly, where I think there's a bit of wires. A few things have gone horribly wrong. One great thing about my Hammond in the 70s and early Yes days, I actually kept initially the bottom part of the casework. It was in my drinking days. One of the things that I found that the inside of the Hammond was good for, I could get a set of two optics underneath each side. I'd have a port one, I'd have a brandy, I'd have a whiskey. I can't remember what the other one was, but we'd have a four there. My roadie, as they were then called, Toby, he used to lie under the Hammond in case anything went wrong, because stuff used to break down all the time back then. Unfortunately, he was incapable of fixing anything except for a very good drink. So what he would do, he would consistently hand me up the drinks for me. I'd just be playing away and point down at the scotch, and he'd have pour a Coca-Cola into it, whatever. One particular piece was about 15, 16 minutes long. Well, I didn't have a busting lot to do. I used to get quite bored, so I'd have a chat with Toby under the Hammond. He said to me, "What are you doing after the concert?" I said, "I'm going for a curry." And he said, "What are you having?" "Chicken vindaloo, Bombay aloo, pilau rice, bindi bhaji, four papadum and a stuffed paratha." And I carried on playing. About 20 minutes later, I can smell curry. And I looked down and he's got it all. And I said, "Toby, after the show." He went, "Oh, I thought you meant that." He said, "Well, you better eat it, get cold." So I laid it all out on the top of the Hammond. Another great thing Hammond was good for, flat top. So I laid it all out, and it woke most of the audience up. They smelt it.
Truth about keyboard playing, in the kind of rock and roll R&B idiom, is the less you do, the better it is. And that's why the kind of daddy of them all is Booker T. Booker T and the MGs, arguably the greatest group of all time, instrumental group, two black men, two white men, all absolutely masterful on their instruments in a really restrained way. I often think Green Onions by Booker T and the MGs has a good claim to be the greatest record ever made. It's just absolutely perfect and spare.
For David Hepworth, Green Onions might be the high watermark for the Hammond. But for many, it's a track which holds the record as the most played song on British radio. And on its release in May 1967, it became one of the anthems of the Summer of Love. Central to Whiter Shade of Pale by Procol Harum is an organ melody inspired by the composer Johann Sebastian Bach and co-written by a then 21-year-old called Matthew Fisher. Here's Matthew talking to the BBC in 2011. We skip
the
life
and dangle. The funny thing was, you see, it's like I had this idea that it would be great to have a pop record, if you like, that used some of the features of a Bach choral prelude. I mean, that's sort of an idea I had at the back of my mind before I joined Procol. It was just burning away there. Sometimes you just add two chemicals together, they immediately form this reaction. It was that kind of thing. I mean, it was as soon as I started playing it, I just fell into that style of playing. What it is not is just taking some piece of Bach and saying, I wrote this. It's a quotation, it's a reference, but it's not a complete 100% rip-off.
By the 1970s, the Hammond organ's ubiquitous presence straddled just about every musical genre, from jazz to blues to rock. When my band, Pink Floyd, recorded Dark Side of the Moon in 1972, Richard Wright's use of the Hammond on such tracks as Us and Them helped give the record that celestial, otherworldly quality. One organist who found himself in high demand by some of the biggest recording artists of that time was Jean Roussel.
When I worked with Cat Stevens, the visual aspect of it was great, the look of the Hammond organ, and also the Cat Stevens situation was based around two acoustic guitars. Occasionally we used acoustic piano on stage, but to give that warmth, that whole surrounding orchestral type sound, we use Hammond organ on almost all the songs, a different degrees of sound largeness. So for songs like Peace Train, Bitter Blue, Tuesday's Dead, I'd really go to work on the volume and the drawbars.
While working with Cat Stevens, Jean caught the attention of Island Records boss Chris Blackwell, the individual often credited with bringing reggae music to a Western audience. And there was one artist Chris was keen for Jean to work with.
There were two of us who were really the on-call house keyboard players, a guy called John Bundrick, who's an American player. We used to basically do all the keyboard, the majority of the keyboard work for Island Records. There's always that organ. Stir it up. Little darling, stir it up. Etc., etc.
While helping to shape the sound of Bob Marley, there was one track which Jean felt the Hammond could play a key role, and his inspiration came from an unlikely source.
It was the first time I'd heard a reggae song where we could give this influence of classical music, because I came from a classical background, a reggae or pop song, and have it shine. I can definitely say that I was highly influenced by the fact that Matthew Fisher had already done it with White Shade of Pale. So I thought of this, you know. So we have this continual non-reggae organ. I was not going to put the famous reggae pump that everybody expects on records, which is that famous beat. I think there are three Hammond organs there, and also there's a pad which is on a slow rotation, which is very church, maybe higher octave. We then compiled that after we'd done three tracks, and then we added at least another one, maybe two Hammond, to give the melody and the intro, something like that. There you go. So it was all in planning. You have to plan ahead. Am I proud of the song? Well, I can't be proud of the song because I didn't write it. But I'm definitely proud and honoured to have worked with such a great artist as Bob Marley, and very much feel very blessed to have been given the opportunity to contribute that melody to the intro and the conception of the whole arrangement and production of that song. As I'm standing in line with the old age pensioners, and I tapped the woman in front of me with her two walking sticks, I said, "Oh, that was me, mate." No, I don't do that. It brings a smile to everybody's face, what can I say, every time you hear it. No woman, no cry.
Thanks to the likes of Jean Roussel, the Hammond gave Bob Marley a helping hand to global stardom. But these organs were finding their way onto the island of Jamaica as early as the late 50s. First installed in churches, they were soon found in recording studios. Lloyd Bradley is a music journalist and author of Bass Culture, when reggae was king.
Ska was a kind of raucous, good time, post-independence, jolly up. And rocksteady came in, which was a much cooler, more mellow dancing style. The Hammond played a big part in making that shift in the mid-60s. The producer Duke Reed would have been one of the pioneers of this with his classic rock steady tracks that would be backing three-part harmony groups and single singers like Paragons, The Techniques, The Melodians, that sort of thing. Jump right on. If you ask six different Jamaican record producers what started something off, you'll get half a dozen different answers, and they'll all be true.
Well said.
One that is really prominent about how reggae came about, which was a far jerkier, more syncopated structure than rocksteady, was because Randy's studio in North Parade, where a lot of producers and artists recorded, had an organ that was broken. Bunny Lee, one of the original reggae producers, told me this story, that his organ player, Glenn Adams, had to hit the keys so hard, the notes almost bounced and got that popping, bubbling reggae sound out of it.
Listen here, I'm totally together.
Jackie Mittu was Studio One's arranger and resident Hammond player. I think if you look at any Jackie Mittu track recorded on Studio One, during the late 60s, early 70s, you really can't go wrong.
By the time Lawrence Hammond died in 1973, his invention had, whether he liked it or not, played a role in shaping the sound of post-war popular culture. But not long after his death, the company he left behind soon struggled to keep up with rapid technological and social change. In a bid to save money, the company replaced their famous tone wheels with circuit boards, a first leap into the digital era. But these proved less popular with musicians. At the same time, the once thriving domestic market began to wane as home organs were replaced with more portable, affordable, and fashionable instruments, such as the guitar. The company eventually folded in 1985, just as they were developing a Premier organ in tribute to their late boss. Here's engineer Ray Gerlich again.
The last organ was going to be called the Lawrence Hammond organ, but it never saw manufacturing. It had a digital synthesizer in it for its time. It had the drawbars on it. It had a string ensemble in it. And at that time, we owned Leslie, and it was going to have a matching tone cabinet. And unfortunately, that cabinet never left engineering. It never got stuffed.
When the factory in Chicago finally closed its doors, it was the end of an era for thousands of employees, such as Jerry Welch.
This plant that we're in was the main source of a humongous garage sale. They literally sold everything, kind of a sad two-week period. They did not auction off the spare parts for several reasons, but the two main ones were obviously you're going to have a lot of customers over the next several years looking for spare parts. So we did start back in 1985 with a lot of spare parts. Over the years, we have sold most of them, certainly all of the assemblies. I don't anymore have any woodwork whatsoever. I mean, it's all been sold. I think the biggest problem that's going to occur is the loss of qualified service personnel. The situation is life with them. They're running out of it. You know, they're just passing.
Eventually, the Hammond name was purchased by the Suzuki Corporation, and to this day, they manufacture digital organs and Leslie speakers in West Chicago. As you'll hear in future episodes of this series, the relationship between music and technology has only become more entwined and codependent down the years. So it's perhaps no wonder a 100-year-old piece of technology has struggled in the digital era. Sex, love, sound. But don't write the Hammond off just yet. A whole new generation are discovering the power of the instrument. That's why organist Clarence McDonald got the call from Justin Timberlake to help him out on his album Future Sex, Love Sounds.
Justin is a class guy. His two favorite singers were Al Green and Bill Withers. So the average age of the band on Future Sex was, I think, 61 or 62. Organ meant Hammond B3. Nobody even questioned what it was going to be. The only question was, do you want one or two Leslies?
But it's not just established musicians looking for a certain something only a Hammond can provide. As we heard before the break, growing up in the 1950s, the likes of Clarence McDonald learnt their trade in church, a tradition that still exists today. This is taken from an online video of Corey Henry at his local church in Brooklyn, New York, demonstrating his organ skills aged just 3. Today, aged 31, he has a successful solo career and tours with the likes of P. Diddy and Lauryn Hill.
While we listened to records, you know, I was on organ eating cereal. Growing up in church, I played, you know, every Sunday was about 68 hours a Sunday. I just feel the Hammond organ somehow, it just connects to the soul.
I only wanted to see you laughing.
Following the death of Prince in April 2016, Corey Henry was asked to pay tribute to the late musician by using the Hammond to reimagine Purple Rain, performed here with the Metropole Orchestra and conductor Jules Buckley.
I just remember being on the organ, coming with this arrangement, and it felt like church. You know, it had this like spiritual church element, but it was his song. I feel like maybe that was the importance of the organ, because it was like, you know, maybe like him playing a guitar. You know, that's why I love the organ, you know, because the organ could just do so many different things and I can get so many emotions out of the instrument.
I never wanted to be your weakened lover, yeah.
But is it possible for musicians like Corey to get the same emotional sound out of a computer-generated version of the instrument? Jean Roussel.
You must understand that these Japanese or these German technicians have gone into recording studios with great musicians and great technicians, and they have them play a great Hammond organ with multiple sounds. They then record that multiple sound into a computer chip. So when you say that this doesn't sound like a Hammond organ, open your ears, mate, because it is an Hammond organ.
But the question that we're missing here is, will it feel like it?
One of my bosses at Hammond used to say, what makes us different? That's just the feel. And he'd get mad at me. Oh, give me something finite. No, if you ask the artists, what is it about a Hammond organ? It's the feel.
A Hammond organ cannot be replicated by a computer. It's the only instrument that I feel is, like, left.
I guess my feeling is that, yes, you can use a computer to get the tone wheels. You're going to spend some time at it. It isn't like you're going to take your laptop and make it happen. It's going to be a dedicated processor with a lot of electronics.
My feeling is on it, they're as close as they've ever been, but they will never be the same. And I think everyone's always striving to make it as close as possible. It's the imperfections and the flaws of the organs that made it sound how it sounded.
Coming up in the next edition, we thought it only right that the synthesizer get a fair hearing.
The machines spoke to me. They seemed to be living, warm beings.
I wasn't alone in thinking that this was the future of music.
But for now, thanks for listening to A History of Music and Technology with me, Nick Mason. The programme was mixed by James Beard and produced by Craig Smith. The editor is Jasper Corbett. It was made in association with the Open University.